Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Lord of the Rings AMA podcast. My name is Matthias Austin, and on this podcast, I invite you to ask me anything about Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, or anything related to the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, and I'll do my best to give you as in-depth an answer as I can. Now, before we get to this week's question, I want to start by giving a huge thank you to Lauren Ciotti, who created our amazing cover art for the podcast. Lauren is a talented artist and graphic designer. Give her a follow on Instagram. A link is in the show notes for that. Also in the show notes is our email address where you can submit your questions. That email address is lotramapod@gmail.com. And our question this week is a little different than the last few. I normally lean pretty heavily into the lore and the history of the story, but I've been on vacation most of the last week, so I chose a question that's a little easier to research and focused more on the films. So our question today comes from Stan in Scotland. What are the most important or interesting parts or storylines from the books that get left out of the movies? Thank you for that question, Stan. Now, it might go without saying, but I'll say it anyway. If you've only seen the movies and want to or are planning to read the books, there will be spoilers for a story originally published in 1954. I think everybody should read the books, but I also believe there's no such thing as being a quote-unquote true fan, and any way you choose to experience the story of Lord of the Rings is perfectly valid. But if you don't want to hear spoilers, maybe come back to this episode. Or just turn the volume down and let it play on silent so the listens count towards the algorithm. And speaking of the algorithm, if you like this podcast, feel free to leave a 5-star review. The more reviews we get, the more people will see this recommended to them, and the more this whole thing can grow. Okay, so the plugs are done, and spoilers from here on out for book plot lines that were omitted from the movies. Now, I think the best way to tackle this is to go movie by movie, and I'll highlight what I think are the most important differences and what those add to the story. Now, in any adaptation from book to film, changes have to be made, since they're different mediums, right? Internal thoughts must be put into dialogue, complex explanations need to be simplified, and despite the length of the movies, the approximately 12 hours of the extended editions still can't cover everything in the 1,100-plus pages of the books. And I do think, for the most part, Peter Jackson, Philippa Boyens, and Fran Walsh did an incredible job with the adaptation of The Lord of the Rings. And I understand most of the changes they made. Side note, this will only be about The Lord of the Rings. If I went into all of the differences between The Hobbit book and The Hobbit trilogy of movie, we would be here for days. So let's just start with The Fellowship of the Ring. The first thing to highlight actually featured heavily in last week's episode about why Frodo couldn't destroy the ring, which is the timeline of events. In the movies, it seems like Frodo has the ring for about a year in total. In the books, there is a 17-year gap to the very day between Frodo receiving the ring from Bilbo and starting his journey to Rivendell. And a lot happens during that 17 years. And if you want to hear more about that, just go listen to last week's episode. I went into all of that there. One thing I didn't mention there is that this timeline adjusts Frodo's age. In the movies, the four hobbits seem roughly the same age. However, in the books, Frodo is 50, Sam is 38, Merry is 36, and Pippin is 28. And this age difference matters quite a bit in terms of their characterization, particularly for Frodo and Pippin. 50 for a hobbit is nearing middle age. Most hobbits lived to around between 80 and 100. Bilbo was extraordinary because the ring allowed him to live unchanged to 111. So Frodo isn't meant to be this young, naive go-getter. He's reached maturity, and he's supposed to be wiser than the other hobbits. By contrast, hobbits aren't meant to come of age until 33. So Pippin being 28 is the equivalent in our time as maybe being like 16. So his immaturity in the books comes from his youth, not, as the movies would seem to imply, he's just stupid. Another thing that's left out is the class structure of the hobbits. I'm not going to get into the full aristocracy of the Shire, but in essence, Merry and Pippin are heirs to the equivalent of lords, the Brandybucks and the Tooks. And Frodo is a wealthy landowner who is related to these aristocratic families. The three of them are upper crust people. They are the creme de la creme of Hobbit society. Sam, on the other hand, is not. He is very low class. In the movies, the four of them go out drinking together. They have jokes. But in the books, it's very clear that Sam is of the servant class, which is why Sam calls him Mr. Frodo all the time. And it changes the dynamic of how all of them interact with each other. Now, Frodo's departure from Hobbiton is very different in the books than the movies. In the movies, he gets the ring, Gandalf goes away, he comes back, he says, "This is the ring, it's evil, you need to leave now," and then we cut to him and Sam starting their journey. In the books, he sells Bag End to his loathsome relative, the Sackville Bagginses, and he buys another home out in Buckland, which is in the east of the Shire. I think this is important because it shows Frodo not as someone just panickedly doing what Gandalf says, but he's someone making a real deep sacrifice for the mission. He's selling his ancestral home to his family's bitter rivals in the Sackville Bagginses. So he's giving up a lot to go on this versus in the movies he kind of just takes off. Now next up, there's a fifth hobbit that starts on the adventure with them. That's their friend Fredegar, also called Fatty, Bulger. Now, he serves a very important purpose in the early part of the story, where he lives in that house that Frodo buys in Buckland and serves as a distraction to the Nazgul, buying the other hobbits time to get a good way along their journey. He also alerts the hobbit town guard of the Nazgul attack on Frodo's home, and horns are blown, and the hobbits are riled up, and we see the hobbits gearing up to defend themselves. It shows this other dynamic to the hobbits that we're actually going to come back to later in this episode. Now, the biggest and maybe most controversial storyline cut from Fellowship is when the four hobbits, leaving Fatty behind, enter the Old Forest, where they meet Tom Bombadil. Now, who is Tom Bombadil? Well, he's a merry fellow, bright blue his jacket is, and his boots are yellow. And that's about all you can say to describe him. He lives in the Old Forest, he's married to Goldberry, the river's daughter, whatever that means. He sings and dances around, and he can command trees. This happens in the extended edition of The Two Towers, where Merry and Pippin get sort of eaten up by this willow tree, Old Man Willow, and then Treebeard comes by and he tells Old Man Willow, "Let them go." Well, in the books, this happens in the Old Forest, and it's Tom Bombadil who says, "Old Man Willow, you let them go. Stop being so naughty and go back to sleep. You shouldn't be waking." But he says it as a song, and it's all in rhyme, and he probably does like a little choreographed dance with it. But Tom is interesting. He actually is able to wear the ring, and it is not something that turns him invisible. He isn't tempted by it in any way. So he's this being of immense power that shows up for three chapters and then never again. And readers often get annoyed by him, one, because he never stops singing, and two, because who even is he? There's an entire episode that could be devoted to Tom, but since we get no answers and since movie runtimes are limited, I do understand why he was cut. But there is a flow-on effect to this omission. There's a chapter in the books where the four hobbits, leaving Tom in the Old Forest, end up getting captured by Barrow-wights, which are undead evil creatures that capture them and drag them down into ancient tombs. And Frodo sings this song that Tom taught him to call, "If you're within the sight of the forest, sing this song, Tom will appear." And so Tom shows up and he drives the wights away. And then he goes back into the tombs and he brings out these weapons that he gives the hobbits for them to use on their adventure. And these weapons, the hobbits use them as swords, but they're probably like knives because hobbits are little. And these knives were forged like 1,000 years before this in the war against the Witch King of Angmar, the leader of the Nazgul. These blades had been inscribed with runes and were specifically made to combat the Witch King. And it's one of these blades that Merry uses when he stabs the Witch King in Return of the King, which creates that weakness that Eowyn exploits when she kills him, thus fulfilling the purpose of the sword's creation. In the movies, it's just a random sword. Is this essential for the story? Well, no. But I think it does add a cool, sort of interesting layer to an already epic moment. The next big change is replacing the character of Glorfindel with Arwen as the person who saves Frodo and gets him to Rivendell. I've talked about Glorfindel in past episodes, but he was an elf lord who, in the first age of Middle-earth, died fighting a Balrog. He was reincarnated in Valinor, as all elves will be eventually, and then he was sent back to Middle-earth by the Valar to help fight Sauron. He's also only in the books for maybe two chapters, and then he just stays in Rivendell. Conversely, in the books, Arwen has maybe 10 mentions total in all three books in the trilogy. Definitely less than 20. So I think this was actually a good change because it gives Arwen more to do than just be an object of desire for Aragorn. So while I do love the lore behind Glorfindel, I think it's better that we got more of Arwen. There are a lot of little differences in the Council of Elrond, as seen on screen versus on the page, but I think the most significant one is that in the movies it's implied that everyone shows up because they got an invitation from Elrond. In the books, everyone shows up at the time by seemingly coincidence. Legolas and his retinue showed up because they needed to report to Aragorn that Gollum had escaped. They had been watching him at Aragorn and Gandalf's instructions. The dwarves were there because a messenger from Mordor arrived at Erebor, or the Lonely Mountain, offering them one of the Dwarven Rings of Power in exchange for an alliance, and they wanted Elrond's advice about what the heck should we do about this. Boromir was there because he and his brother Faramir had been having a dream telling them to go to Rivendell, and Boromir offered to go instead of Faramir. All of this spoke to this larger purpose with like a capital P moving in the world. The will of Iluvatar, perhaps. But there's just not time in the movies to get into something so big thematically. So they just made it seem like Elrond sent out this call. Another change in the Fellowship is that before they leave Rivendell, Aragorn has the Shards of Narsil, reforged as Anduril, signifying his purpose to reclaim the throne of Gondor and Arnor. Whereas in the movies, that happens in Return of the King at the urging of Arwen, and Elrond delivers it to him in Dunharrow. It's a culminating character moment for an unwilling king in the movies, which is a very different character than the triumphant returning king. Aragorn can't stop talking about how he's the king of Gondor returning to his land to free his people in the books. Moria pretty much happens. There's a few minor differences as they travel down through Moria. There's some line differences. I do think that the movie's version of "you shall not pass" is an improvement on Tolkien, but in the book, when Gandalf stops the Balrog, he says, "You cannot pass. I am a wielder of the sacred fire, servant of the sacred fire, wielder of the flame of Anor. The dark fire shall not avail you, flame of Udun. You cannot pass." But in this one, in the movies, Gandalf has more power. It's a much bigger cinematic moment with the "you shall not pass" as he slams the thing and the bridge collapses down. But it's just minor sort of differences. The next larger difference we see is that in Lothlorien, when they are leaving there, they get these gifts from Galadriel. This is in the extended edition of the movies, but in the book, Sam is given a box that has soil from Galadriel's personal garden. And we're going to come back to that later. Now, most of the rest of the Fellowship is accurate, but they did cut out a cool scene after they leave Lothlorien where one of the Nazgul on a flying fell beast is shot out of the sky by Legolas in the pitch black of night. With all the cool things they made up for Legolas to do, like, you know, ride a shield downstairs or take down an Oliphant by himself, they cut out one of the actual best moments that he has in the books. They also invent the character of Lurtz, this sort of big hulking Uruk-hai that Sauron sends after him. I talked about that in a previous episode, too, where I think they just did that to give a more personal villain in the end of the Fellowship. I don't know how I feel about that. I don't think it was necessary, but it's cool for Aragorn to have somebody to square off with specifically. That's pretty much it, though, for the Fellowship. Some characters, like I said, are added, like Lurtz. Some are omitted, like Bill Ferney. But it's probably the most accurate adaptation of the three. So on to the Two Towers. And this is the film that I think has the most divergence from the book. A big part of that is because the Battle of Helm's Deep in the movie, epic, awesome battle, takes up somewhere between, I'd say, a third and almost half of the movie, but it gets one chapter in the book. The Battle of Helm's Deep is a single chapter, and it's not even a very long chapter. As a result, Peter Jackson, because he wanted to make that the big culminating battle of the movie, had to add all these things for Frodo and Sam to do, which led to what I think is a character assassination of Faramir. All of the Shelob stuff that happens in the book, The Two Towers, they move that to Return of the King. And when Sam and Frodo meet Faramir, he isn't conflicted about the ring in the book. He doesn't try to take them to Osgiliath. He never threatens them. Book Faramir acts as like a better version of Boromir. He's never tempted, but he's always wise and kind. But they needed to give Sam and Frodo something to do while Legolas surfed down the stairs of Helm's Deep, so they added this whole subplot. Perhaps, maybe, it's a more interesting character choice to give him some of that internal conflict. Maybe not. I don't love it, but it does lead to Sam's, you know, there's some good in this world and it's worth fighting for speech, which makes me cry every time I see it. So maybe it was worth it in the end. I don't know. Back on the Rohan side of things, they add this big warg fight on the way to Helm's Deep, and that doesn't happen in the books. Aragorn doesn't fall off a cliff into a river. He doesn't hallucinate about Arwen. Arwen isn't even in the book. So again, I understand the why in terms of giving her more of an active part of the story, but a lot of this section of the movie kind of just feels like it's treading water. Pun fully intended. There are also no elves at Helm's Deep in the book. Haldir doesn't arrive with this, you know, battalion of elvish archers, and he doesn't die there. The elves are actually otherwise occupied at that point in the story, which we will also get to later. It's a good scene in the movie. It's very inspirational, so I don't mind it. I think that's an okay change. This book's Glorfindel, a.k.a. guy who shows up for a small bit and is awesome, but then he never comes back, is a guy named Erkenbrand. Erkenbrand is the leader of one of the segments of the Rohirrim cavalry. And that's who Gandalf goes off to find, because Éomer is actually at Helm's Deep, fighting alongside Gimli in the caves, while the other characters end up in that, like, castle section of Helm's Deep. Again, it makes sense they cut this character. He doesn't have lasting impact in terms of, like, the entire story. So I get why they cut him, and it made sense to move Éomer to be the one that Gandalf goes to find. Also, the Ents are not tricked by Merry and Pippin into attacking Orthanc. They don't say, no, we're not going to do it, and then they say, well, why don't you take us this way to lead us out of the forest? And then they just so happen to come across Isengard or Orthanc. No, the Ents actually, when they have their Ent mood, they decide, yeah, we're going to fight. Let's go. I think I actually do like the movie version of this better, because it gives Merry and Pippin more of an active role in the story, and it particularly shows that Pippin isn't just a dummy, which he's kind of the butt of the joke a lot of the time. Okay, so now we come to Return of the King. And this is the one with the most cut out compared to the books, and it's still the longest movie. Partly it's because they're catching up, since Helm's Deep messed with the timeline of the previous movie, so a lot of stuff that should have been in Two Towers got moved to Return of the King, and so that extended everything out, right? So I'll start with the Glorfindel of this book, which is Prince Imrahil of Dol Amroth. This is Denethor's brother-in-law, and he's this great leader in Gondor, and everywhere he goes, the men of Gondor are encouraged. He's a really cool character that actually takes over temporarily as the steward after Denethor, you know, sets himself on fire and Faramir is recovering in the House of Healing. And he acts as like this advisor to Aragorn. And I think he would have actually been a pretty fun inclusion. I think that was a missed opportunity. In that same vein, there's these other characters. Beregond, he's one of the guards of the Citadel. And he befriends Pippin and shows him like what his duties are after he pledges his allegiance to Gondor. And we get a lot more of the results of Pippin's decision to pledge himself to Denethor. Beregond also ends up saving Faramir's life by fighting off Denethor's men long enough to allow Gandalf time to arrive and confront Denethor. And his son, Beregond's son, Beregol, also befriends Pippin. And I think both of those characters could have been good inclusions, specifically Beregond, to see sort of somebody else in Gondor in the guards standing up to Denethor when he was having his mental breakdown. Another thing in the movie that's very different. Aragorn in the movies, he brings this green CGI army of the dead to Pelennor Field to save the day at the very end of the battle. And this is drastically different in the book. In the book, there's this whole separate army of Gondorians on the southern coast waiting to defend themselves from the corsairs of Umbar coming up the river. And the army of the dead, Aragorn brings them to attack the corsairs, and I don't think they're actually like swinging swords and actively chopping people up. No, they just scare them because it's an army of ghosts, and they scare the corsairs so much that they leap off of their boats into the water, and it puts them at a disadvantage in the fight with the army that was there, and it allows the Gondorians to rout them. Then they take their ships, and they sail up with this army of humans, not the army of the dead, who are then dismissed because, hey, you did your job, you scared the guys off the boats, you can be free now. And it's mostly an army of humans because Aragorn is joined on the paths of the dead by 30 rangers of the north, other Dunedain, who arrive with this big flag of the King of Gondor that was created by Arwen. And along with them come the twin sons of Elrond, Eladan and Elrohir, who fight with the good guys all throughout the end of Return of the King. It would have been cool, I think, to see that there are more rangers in the north than just Aragorn, and also cool to have, this sort of elven princes, these sons of Elrond there, but you're adding more characters that you gotta learn names of into an already packed book. So, again, I understand the exclusion on that. So that's the army that comes up from the south, but there's a whole other thing that happens with the Rohirrim when they are coming down to help from the north. During the Ride of the Rohirrim, Sauron has sent this second army to block the road to prevent reinforcements from coming to Gondor. And they outnumber the Rohirrim. But the Rohirrim are led around this army of orcs through a place called the Druidane Forest. And they're led by this guy named Gonburi Gon. And he's the chief of the last sort of vestiges of the indigenous people who lived in that area before the Numenoreans arrived thousands of years ago and started settling in Gondor. So Gonburi Gon, his people have been oppressed. They say that they've been like hunted by Rohirrim and by Gondorians. They're this sort of oppressed minority living off this ever dwindling ancestral land. Not making a political statement, but hey, maybe Tolkien was. And Gonburi Gon, he does not like, he knows Sauron is worse than humans and will be way worse for him because Sauron will hate anybody who's not an orc. So he's like, I'm going to help you guys on the condition that, hey, we can be left alone after this. And they, Théoden is there and he says, yep, absolutely. We're not going to touch you guys. Thank you for this. They lead the army through these woods around that big army. And that way they're able to charge over to Minas Tirith and they get there just in time to save everybody. And when Aragorn is the king at the end, he makes this proclamation officially granting the Druidane Forest to Gonburi Gon and his people forever. Similarly, Aragorn visits the Forest of Fangorn and makes the same type of promise to Treebeard and the Ents. And I really do like these scenes in the book, and I think that it's unfortunate that they had to be cut, since it shows a lot more complexity to the world than the movies are able to give us. When Frodo is recovering after destroying the ring, Gandalf tells him about these other fronts of the war that we never had heard about. elves in Lothlorien were being attacked by Sauron's forces from Dol Guldur in the south of Mirkwood, and they fended them off. They defended themselves three times before they were able to finally break through and attack them and drive them back, drive the bad guys back. So that's why the elves would have been too busy to travel down and help out at Helm's Deep. We also hear about the dwarves of Erebor and the men of Dale defeating this army of Easterlings that were attacking them, but they lost their leaders in the process. The king under the mountain and the leader of the men of Dale die in that battle. And in the books, Gandalf just sort of tells us these things happened. But man, what an opportunity we missed by the movies not including that, because they could have showed us that happening. It wouldn't have to be a lot. They could just show these clips of these other things happening. I understand why it was cut out. Return of the King is already accused of having 12 different endings, but I think it would have been really cool to see these other sections of the world where this was not an isolated event. This was kind of a world war. And despite having a million endings, Return of the King cut out the actual ending of the book as the remainder of the Fellowship make their way back up to Rivendell. Along the way, they lose Gimli and Legolas, who went to explore Fangorn Forest, and Aragorn has to return to Gondor to be the king. They stop at Isengard, where Treebeard informs them that he lets Saruman go, and that Grima Wormtongue was still with him, and they headed out. Gandalf suspects that Saruman maybe had used some of the power, magical power in his voice to sway Treebeard, but, oh well, nothing he could do about it now, and they just kind of continue along. On the road to Rivendell, they pass Saruman and Wormtongue, and they offer to help them. Saruman spits at them, he kicks Wormtongue, and they continue on their way. Gandalf and the hobbits stay in Rivendell for a few months before finally heading back to the Shire. And on the way to the Shire, Gandalf stops off at the Old Forest, saying he wants to talk to Tom Bombadil and catch up with him. And so the hobbits continue on their own. But when they get back to the Shire, what they find there shocks them. Walls and like traffic stops, armed guards are now blocking the road. There's this expanded police force claiming that they got to check everybody in and you got to follow all these new rules. And they're taking their orders from the chief of the hobbits. We'll get into that in a second. And they try to arrest the four hobbits when they get back. But the hobbits have on their armor, their swords, they're riding on their ponies, and they say, "All right, well, good luck arresting us." And then they just kind of continue on past them, and the Hobbit police force are like, we'll escort you, but they kind of just go along because they have nothing they can do. They are not really armed. The Hobbit police aren't able to stop them, but when they get into a larger town, there's a bigger force of big folk, and it kind of seems like the books say they're possibly orc-human hybrids. The text's unclear. They say they're orc-like people. Don't know what that means, but they said they had seen similar people when Saruman was in Isengard before the Ents destroyed Saruman's forces there. So those larger group of big folk accost them, and they fight them. The hobbits actually fight them off. The four hobbits are able to they've just come from a war and they've had military training. They're able to scare them off. And they get reports that Lotho Sackville Baggins is the chief hobbit. So this is the guy, the son of Bilbo's enemies, Lobelia, and forget her husband's name, that they ended up selling Bag End to. Frodo sold Bag End to them. Their son is Lotho, and he's now the chief. He's the chief hobbit. But there's also a mysterious guy named Sharky running things behind the scenes. Sam's home and all of the homes that are for the lower class people in Hobbiton have been torn down and shacks have been put up in their place. There's new machinery belching smoke into the air. And the great party tree where Bilbo's 111th birthday was celebrated, it's been torn down. The hobbits are being oppressed by big folk and forcing the hobbit police to enforce all their rules. They also hear that the Tooks and Brandybucks are kind of leading guerrilla attacks on any humans coming near their territory, because they don't live in, like, central, like, Hobbiton's sort of the center of the Shire. Tookland and Buckland are sort of off to the east, and they're kind of running the Tooks and Bucklanders are running, like, a guerrilla resistance movement. So Merry and Pippin go off to go organize them and bring them back to help clear out Hobbiton. Sam and Frodo, but mostly, honestly, Sam, starts organizing the Hobbiton Hobbits. We get some actual scenes where we see Sam talk to Rosie Cotton, and she actually has lines of dialogue, unlike in the movies, and we actually get to see some of the relationship between her and Sam in the way that the movies never show us. So the Hobbits set up a trap for the big folks. They try to get them to leave peacefully, but eventually a battle does occur with over 300 Hobbits coming in versus, like, I think it's like 120 big folk. And most of those Hobbits were brought in by Merry and Pippin. 70 men die, as do 19 Hobbits, but the Hobbits end up winning. And they march their little army to Bag End, where Sharky and Lotho, the chief, have set up their headquarters. They discover that Sharky is, in fact, Saruman, who thinks the name is a term of endearment from his men, but it may actually be a mishearing on his part of the Orcish word Sharku, which means old man. And they find out that Lotho was murdered in his sleep by Grima, Wormtongue. So surrounded and without any power, his staff is broken, Saruman is forced to surrender. And despite all of the evil he's done, Frodo still offers him his freedom. Frodo's just tired of war and fighting. He says, you know what? You were once a powerful wizard. Go. Just go. And Saruman, at that, hates Frodo, pulls out a knife, tries to stab Frodo, but the mithril coat stops the blade. Saruman then kicks Grima, tells the Hobbits, by the way, this guy, Grima Wormtongue, he's the one who killed Lotho, your chief, so, you know, he's a bad guy too. At which point, Grima just snaps, and he pulls out his dagger, and he kills Saruman. And then he starts to run off, but he's shot by archers, Hobbit archers, as he tries to escape. And so Saruman and Grima die at the foot of the door of Bag End. And Saruman, being a Maia like Gandalf, and if you don't remember what that is, listen to episode 3 of the podcast. But he's not really dead because he's an immortal being. But his some sort of spirit rises into the air, and it says he looks towards the west. And out of the west comes a cold wind, and it disperses his spirit off into the east. Really cool imagery of, and again, another hint to this larger mythology. You have the powers of the Valar over in Valinor denying Saruman his return because of all the evil he's done. So after that, Frodo, being an aristocrat, he's elected mayor. But Sam ends up doing all of the real work of restoring the Shire. He takes the soil and he sprinkles it all around the areas that have been destroyed, that soil that he got from Galadriel. And inside the box is also a nut from one of the giant trees of Lothlorien, which Sam plants where the party tree was. And we see how the very next year the Shire blooms and quickly returns to its former glory, and the tree that was planted grows swiftly, and it's the only Malorn tree west of the Anduin River, because Lothlorien's to the east, and east of Valinor. We see Frodo only serves one term as mayor, and again, I'm not making a political statement here, but maybe Tolkien was, where the book says the only thing he did was reduce the size of the police force to a more manageable size, back to what it was meant to be, just like people doing spot checks around, not this big militaristic force that Saruman had built up. And then after Frodo is done with his one term, Sam is elected mayor, a position that he keeps for years and years and years, like for most of the rest of his life. They just keep electing him back as mayor because he does such a good job. And then the book continues on, as the movie does, with Frodo, Bilbo, Gandalf, and some of the prominent elves sailing off into the west, while Sam returns to Bag End and says, well, I'm back. And I do wish they had found a way to keep that whole ending in, because I think it's nearly a perfect ending. The adventure, the battle, ends exactly where it all started in The Hobbit, at the front door of Bag End. We see Sam elevated to a high status in society. We see the four Hobbits using what they learned on their adventure to better their home. And we see the Hobbits not just as backwards, uninterested bystanders, but active participants in their world. It's a phenomenal ending, but it would probably make the movie 4.5 hours long, which is probably just unmanageable. So those are all of the main things that were different from the books or left out entirely. And I definitely didn't cover everything. Interestingly, Tolkien himself had too much material to make it into the books, which is why, at the end of Return of the Kings, there are multiple appendices. In them, he details the different lineages of the kings of Numenor, Gondor, Arnor, Rohan, the dwarves. He gives a whole scene with like a mini chapter of the meeting of Aragorn and Arwen. You get the entire timeline of all of the Third Age of Middle-earth. You get family trees of hobbits, the different calendar systems everybody uses, how to write and pronounce the different languages, and I mean, that's where people know how to speak Elvish, is because he gives a full pronunciation guide in there. Just all sorts of things. And many people see all of that and say, nah, I already read 1,100 pages, I'm done. So sometimes even book readers don't get the whole story. So, there you go, Stan. I hope that answered your question about interesting and important things left out of the movies. And if anyone out there listened to all of that and you haven't read the books, I hope maybe something I talked about piqued your interest and encourages you to give the book a chance. And if you, like Stan, would like to submit a question, you can email in to lotramapod@gmail.com, and I'll do my best to answer it. Probably won't do this next thing that much, but I'm going to really push hard for reviews here, because since we're still in the early stages of the podcast, ratings and reviews go a long way to getting this moving in the algorithm. So if you've been enjoying the show, I'd love it if you could leave a 5-star rating and review. Thank you again to Lauren for our amazing artwork. And hey, if you're a musician and you feel inspired to come up with a little theme music for the show, send an email, get in touch. I'd love to talk to you about that. And that is all for this week. Iluvatar willing, I'll be back next week. See you then.